all this stuff and just let the private medical insurance companies take the subsidization that was also, as I say, envisioned in Obamacare and apply it to Medicare and Medicaid patients. Anyway, we're out of time.
People need to understand that the economy is their labor. Okay, that's the fundamental thing people understand. It's not money. It's not finance. It's not Wall Street. It's their labor. And until people begin to understand that, they're not going to feel empowered to do something about the kind of just ludicrous nonsense that's put forth as serious discourse about economic policy.
Well, to quote the other Marx, hello, we must be going.
See you next week.
Righto.
Just not working anymore. They used to call us working class. Hello, folks. Welcome to the April 9th, 2011 edition of the Illinois World Labor Hour, brought to you over the air on the WEFT 90.1 FM radio in Champaign, Illinois, and webcast worldwide at WFT.org. The views and opinions expressed during this hour program and those of the speaker do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of WFT's management, board of directors, or Prairie Air Incorporated. Now, here's Tom to acknowledge some of our underwriters.
This hour of programming is being brought to you by you, the listeners of WEFT, and by the Brotherhood of the Maintenance Way. The Brotherhood of the Maintenance Way employees are proud to continue their support for the Illinois World Labor Hour. A democratic union, the BMWE celebrates the voice for labor on WEFT. It is our hope that all workers may share the same benefits that they enjoy, such as living wages, job security, away-from-home expense pay, early retirement, Canadian-style health insurance, and guaranteed year-round work. And the Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by you listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois.
Okay, thank you, Tom. I'm your host, David Johnson, here today with co-host Tom Thomas, who will have some workers' interest news for us, and later in the show, the Labor Hour Cultural Corner. Tom's poem from this week is from his book, Cries for Justice, and it's entitled, They Say. Also here with us today is Bob Plesney, our other co-host and technical advisor, and Jason Kozlowski, our newest member of the Illinois World Labor Hour Collective. And Bill Gorell may be popping in later on. Never know with Bill, but we're always glad when he does show up. Coming up at half past the hour, we have a very special guest who's going to be calling in, thanks to Jason Kozlowski. His name is Dan Labatz. And Jason, you want to just give a little brief intro about who Dan is?
Sure. Dan is a fascinating guy. He had been a Latin American expert as well as someone who has been involved in the labor movement for probably about four decades, helped found Teamsters for a Democratic Union, and has written big books in the labor movement like Troublemaker's Handbook, and most recently last year ran on the Socialist Party ticket for a Senate seat in Ohio.
Okay, that sounds like an interesting person. Definitely, I've heard of Dan Labatz, and of course, I'm familiar with the Troublemaker's Handbook, being a troublemaker myself. So, anyway, I look forward to that. So now we'll just go to some workers' interest news, starting with Tom Thomas.
Speaking from the site of a major road project in Chicago on Thursday, Governor Pat Quinn announced that Illinois plans to repair more than 3,200 miles of worn roads and replace or repair some 611 bridges over the next 6 years. The governor's office estimated that the construction projects will create about 155,000 jobs. The timing of Quinn's announcement was tied to a law that requires the state to announce its long-term roads program. Construction costs through 2017 are estimated at $11.5 billion for an extensive list of projects and would be paid for with federal, state, and local funds. Of the $11.5 billion program, $7.2 billion will be federal money, and more than half of the state contribution, some $2 billion, will be from the plan called Illinois Jobs Now. Two-thirds of the program will be allocated to maintaining Illinois' existing roads and bridges, with the other third to be used for system congestion mitigation. Said Governor Quinn, "The construction and the repair of our highways and our bridges is very, very important for jobs in Illinois and is a good way to get our economy back on track."
Thanks, Tom. Here's a story. As the Obama administration signaled its intent to send the U.S.-Colombia Free Trade Agreement to Congress for ratification, Mary Kay Henry, president of the Service Employees International Union, SEIU, issued the following statement. SEIU cannot support the U.S.-Colombia trade agreement negotiated by President George W. Bush and Colombian President Alvaro Uribe in 2007. This agreement is another example of failed trade policies that have resulted in the loss of millions of U.S. jobs. The Economic Policy Institute has estimated that this agreement will result in the loss of 55,000 jobs in the U.S., the last thing our economy needs. They say, in addition, our brothers and sisters in the Colombian labor movement, the Afro-Colombian community, and human rights advocates face a climate rife with crime and violence. In Colombia, more trade unionists are murdered than anywhere else in the world, and perpetrators are very rarely brought to justice. Since 2007, nearly 200 trade unionists have been murdered, including two in the past week. And also from the AFL-CIO, they say the pending U.S.-Colombia Free Trade Agreement would give special trade preferences to a government that has done little to respect workers' rights. The agreement left over from the Bush administration is another in a series of bad trade pacts negotiated by Bush White House, deals that have contributed to a U.S. trade deficit of $677 billion in 2008, massive job loss, and shrinking paychecks. Such trade deals have contributed to the loss of more than 3 million manufacturing jobs in the United States since 2001. Jason?
Thanks, Bob. Here locally, the union representing food service and building workers at the Urbana campus has announced an intent to strike if it does not reach agreement with the University of Illinois in the next 14 days. Ricky Baldwin, SEIU field organizer, said, "The university has not bargained in good faith from the beginning with the union. We are prepared. We're ready. We have every intention of doing it unless we can reach an agreement." Union members will picket at Florida Avenue Residence Hall, the site of ongoing negotiations, again on Tuesday morning. The university is basically still focusing on some of the more minor issues and claiming they're making movement, Baldwin said. But on job security and wage issues, they're not offering us anything we can live with. The Urbana campus spokeswoman, Robin Kaler, said it was regrettable that the Service Employees International Union has chosen to take this action, saying, quote, "The university consistently has approached these negotiations in good faith and with the intent to reach a mutually beneficial bargaining agreement. We have held negotiation sessions with the federal mediator for both dining service and building service employees, and we had an additional session scheduled with the mediator for the coming week," she'd said in an email, end quote. Baldwin disagreed, saying, "I think their actions say otherwise." He said that the U of I has canceled some negotiations and moved further away from what the union seeks, as well as changing its negotiators. He said the union has a particular issue with the use of temporary workers, creating job insecurity for permanent workers. Local 73, which represents about 800 Urbana campus building and food service workers, requested federal mediation in December.
Okay. Power workers to bring production to a halt was on dramatic display April 4th when longshore workers of the International Longshore and Warehouse Union Local 10 shut down the ports of Oakland and San Francisco for 24 hours in solidarity with the heroic struggles in Wisconsin. The big container port of Oakland was deader than a doornail Monday at 6 a.m. I saw a long snake line of trucks bearing shipping containers idled on the roadway. The shipping cranes were all standing at attention, in other words, not working, and the ILWU hiring hall was practically deserted at dispatch time for the night shift, leaving several hundred jobs unfilled. The docked workers stayed away, and no cargo was worked on any shift Monday in Oakland or San Francisco. The rank-and-file-initiated shutdown was part of a nationwide action on April 4th to challenge the draconian budget cuts and union busting in Wisconsin and other states. An organized act of resistance by rank-and-file dock workers, this was a voluntary rank-and-file action, an organized act of resistance, said Clarence Thomas, a dock worker and Local 10 executive board member. It is significant that the action by Local 10 was taken in solidarity with Wisconsin public sector workers who are facing a loss of collective bargaining. Thomas said he pointed out that April 4th is also the anniversary of the assassination murder of Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., who was killed in Memphis demanding collective bargaining for sanitation workers in that city.
According to a Labor Department report released last week, more than three-quarters of the nation's 372 largest metropolitan areas reported lower unemployment rates in February than in the previous month. The fact that unemployment rates are falling in most metropolitan areas across the country is suggesting that nationwide gains in hiring are widespread and not limited to just a few healthy regions. More than 300 cities have seen their rates of unemployed decline favorably in the last year, the best showing since June of 2009, and 284 metropolitan areas reported job gains in the past year, also the best showing since 2009. Nationwide, private employers added more than 200,000 jobs in February and March of this year, the best two-month pace since 2006. Many of the cities that posted job losses were state capitals. State governments around the country are laying off workers in an effort to reduce huge budget deficits. The metropolitan employment data is distorted by some seasonal trends, such as the layoff of temporary retail employees after the holiday season is over. But since those rates are not seasonally adjusted, they are more volatile from month to month.
Thanks, Tom. Here's a story. After 6 months of investigation and 3 months of appeals, court-appointed election overseers have ordered Teamster President James Hoffa to acknowledge that he attempted to buy election support by offering jobs and pensions. Hoffa must pay for a mailing to all Teamster locals publicizing the attempt. He must also place a notice on the union's website and magazine. The unofficial slap on the wrist is now official, said Barbara Harvey, a lawyer for Teamsters for a Democratic Union, TDU. The judge's decision was finalized on April 1st. The court assigned election supervisor Richard Mark found in January that Hoffa himself and three members of his election team had offered jobs or pensions to two international officers and a high-level official whom they wanted to deter from running on a competing slate. The election for Teamsters president this fall is a three-way race, with Hoffa seeking a third full term in office. He's being challenged by Sandy Pope, president of a Queens, New York local, a reformer running on a platform of building power through rank-and-file participation. And also rifts among Hoffa supporters have resulted in a challenge from Vice President Fred Giger of Green Bay, Wisconsin, and other formerly Hoffa-aligned officials. One of those officials, Fred Zuckerman, the union's car haul division director, said he was offered a raise and pension plan enrollment. They expected me to support the Hoffa slate and not run against them, Zuckerman told the election supervisor. And also international trustees Frank Galagos and Henry Perry were being booted off the Hoffa slate in favor of candidates Hoffa thought could do a better job at voter turnout. Both were asked to resign their elected trustee positions but still support the Hoffa slate. In return, they would get appointed jobs at the same pay. Galagos testified that he didn't take the job offer because he didn't trust Hoffa to follow through. Zuckerman and Perry are now running for vice president positions on Giger's slate, and the bribery attempts were made by Hoffa and Vice Presidents Rome Alois, Ken Hall, and Tyson Johnson. And the election supervisor asks, he says, is it still bribery if they didn't accept it? He says there's no basis to find a violation on the ban of union resources if they didn't accept the bribes. But anyway, Teamster elections have been under court supervision since the settlement of a racketeering lawsuit back in 1989. And the settlement also established direct member election of top officers, a measure that TDU has pushed.
News from France. Electricité de France SA and GDF Suez SA, the former French power and gas monopolies, were hit by a nationwide strike on Thursday over plans to scale back heating subsidies for workers. The strike cut about 9,000 megawatts of power from 12 EDF nuclear plants, said Laurent Langlard, a member of the CGT union, the country's biggest. That represents about 14% of France's total installed nuclear capacity. About 18,000 megawatts of power output were lost in total. About 42% of EDF employees and 49% of GDF Suez energy workers took part in the strike, the Paris-based utilities company said. Employees are staunchly defending a heavily discounted rate paid for electricity that's benefited gas and power workers since before World War II, Langlard said. Quote, EDF wants to scale back that benefit, end quote. The CGT and other unions will meet tomorrow to decide what further action to take. EDF and GDF Suez are under pressure from the government and consumer groups to keep energy prices as low as possible. EDF has proposed that employees should pay taxes on their utility bills, which can account for almost a third of consumers' bills, and that the rate they pay for electricity be linked to that paid by other households. Employees and EDF retirees currently pay a fixed rate for electricity. The utility wants to bring in the changes as a quarter of its workforce is due to retire in the next 5 years. If I may say so, that would be the way here in the U.S. to protest cuts for low-power heating assistance and other things that you're going to see in the upcoming budget.
Indeed. Union members and their supporters are refusing to leave the legislative chamber of the Ontario government after a bipartisan union-sponsored measure to ban the use of strike breakers during strikes and lockouts was defeated. The protesters say they won't leave until they can meet with Premier Dalton McGuinty. Bill 45 would ban the growing practice by employers of hiring scabs to work to avoid collective bargaining. The very nature of labor relations is altered by this well-planned and financed practice, and workers and communities would suffer, said Wayne Fraser, Ontario Director of the United Steelworkers, who is leading a sit-in at Queen's Park. Fraser pointed to the year-long strike against Brazilian mining giant Vale and several multi-year disputes in Toronto, Nanticoke, and Brantford. McGuinty is saying to all of Ontario that workers' rights to free and fair collective bargaining are no longer valid. He has set the stage for a Wisconsin-style attack against every unionized worker in Ontario. He needs to tell us why he has chosen insecurity over community building, and therefore, what is he prepared to do to solve these terrible, unnecessary strikes and lockouts, Fraser said. Okay, we're going to go to a little Jim Hightower, and we'll be right back with Tom Thomas's Poem of the Week.
Good news, people. America's wages are up. The average worker is making more today than a year ago. How much more, you ask? Get ready to be excited. 58 cents a week. Of course, averages don't tell the whole story. Economist John Kenneth Galbraith graphically explained the problem of averages with a story about a 6-foot-tall man who drowned when wading across a stream with an average depth of 3 feet. Similarly, while average workers are trying to decide how to spend those extra 5 dimes, a nickel, and 3 pennies they're getting each week, your average CEO is wallowing in an extra $860,000 this year over last. That's just the increase in their bonuses. It does not include their multimillion-dollar salaries, which are also up, nor their golden pensions, free health care, limousines, corporate jets, etc. And, as you might imagine, many corporate chieftains did much better than average in their bonus checks. Take Robert Iger of Walt Disney, Inc. He pocketed a bonus of $13.5 million this year, 45% more than he got a year ago. Well, explained his PR agent, bonuses provide incentives for excellent executive performance, and Iger deserves his riches this year because Disney's profits are up by 24%. Swell, but why is his increase double that increase in profits? And by the way, Robert's salary is $2 million a year. Why does he need any extra incentive to do his job? One more question. Does Iger really think that he alone produced Disney's rise in profits? Notice that the animators, performers, and other hard-working employees at Disney World and Disney Studios got no 45% increase in their pay. This is Jim Hightower saying, no one goes to Disney World to see Robert Iger. If he wants bonus money, tell him to put on a Mickey Mouse costume in the wilting heat of Florida summer and earn it.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out. HightowerLowdown.org.
We now come to this portion of the Illinois World Labor Hour, the Cultural Corner, with Tom Thomas's Poem of the Week, They Say.
The news reports now coming out all say there's going to be an end to hunger and to homelessness. They say the government's our friend. They say they are creating jobs to house the hungry and the poor. They say the tragedies we've known are sorrows we will see no more. How many times have we heard that? How many times the same old lie? How many workers with no jobs simply had to lay down and die? When a fox kills all your chickens, do you offer it your last egg? Should you support any system when for what's yours you have to beg? Banks and insurance companies are just two foxes at the door, but the hungriest of canines is that fox called illegal war. They rob Social Security to feed that particular one. The sickly can't get medicine, but a tyrant can get a gun. There have been far too many ways our government has lied to us. They've changed the rules of the game enough to make a preacher cuss. They Say was written at the Poets Loft in Champaign, Illinois on May 29th, 2009, and was brought to you live today, April 9th, 2011, here on the Illinois World Labor Hour on WEFT 90.1 FM in Champaign, Community Radio for East Central Illinois.
Okay, thank you, Tom. And public service announcement, tune in this Sunday and every Sunday for Labor's Worldview TV with host Jim Einman, and that's on from 4 to 5 p.m. on Urbana Public Television, Comcast Channel 6. Okay, we're going to be having a very special guest call in here at about half past the hour. So in the meantime, I thought we'd play a little music here from Utah Phillips. So we haven't heard him for a while. So we're going to be playing a song dedicated to a very famous woman, even though March is past in Women's History Month. I don't think we necessarily need a particular month to celebrate special women labor leaders, nor do we need a special month for African-American labor leaders or any other special labor leaders, but this one's a very special one. This is called The Most Dangerous Woman.
I was traveling through Illinois when I was invited to stop and sing at a memorial there in the little town of Mount Olive. Now, who of note in American history is buried in the cemetery in Mount Olive, Illinois? I'll give you a hint. It was a woman. It was the Union Miners Cemetery. Do you have it yet? Mary Harris. Mary Harris Jones. Mother Jones. It's hard for the mind to encompass a life that embraced the presidencies between Andrew Jackson and Herbert Hoover. Why, when Mother Jones was a little girl, there were people still alive who remembered the Revolutionary War. And she died on the eve of the New Deal. Her millinery shop burned down in the Chicago fire, and she had heard Abraham Lincoln speak in person. Mostly, though, Mother Jones was the miner's friend. Down in Kentucky, Tennessee, West Virginia. Well, the men would be organizing the underground workers, the miners. Mother Jones had already organized their wives and led them over the snow-covered game trails down into the Hollis, where, armed with mops and brooms, they drove the scabs out of the coal pits. Now, Mother Jones wasn't an organizer, she was an agitator, which meant often enough she was hated as much by the organizers as by the bosses. One time, Mother Jones was out in Colorado at the great Ludlow strike. Now, that was a strike to enforce the 8-hour day, which the state of Colorado had made a law, but they couldn't enforce it because Rockefeller owned the militia. Now, the governor promised not to send the militia into the coal fields, but he lied, and he did. Mother Jones was in the Union Hall down there at Ludlow, and word came that the militia had entered the coal fields. Well, she leapt up, and she screamed, "Let's go get the sons of bitches!" And she stormed out. She didn't look to see if anybody was following her. Nobody was following her. She just flounced up the road alone and confronted the militia. And that was the year that President Theodore Roosevelt called Mother Jones the most dangerous woman in America. And she was 83 years old. That's some kind of dangerous. Herb Edwards lived in the little town of West Seattle on the other side of Puget Sound. Little tiny house, little bitty kitchen. He was a Norwegian immigrant, gave all of his life to the logging and to the union. He carried his red card in the union every working day of his life. We sat in that little kitchen and he told me the story of the Spokane Free Speech Fight, 1910. I would not attempt to duplicate that rumbling baritone voice or that Norwegian accent, but because of the story, the way he told it, said, "Oh, they boomed into Spokane and towns all over the West, looking for work in the silver mines up in the Coeur d'Alene or in the logging camps or in the wheat harvest, the 110 cats, the great wheat lands that flow away south of Spokane called the Palouse. Well, you jungle up in the flops, wait for the weather to break, and then you go down on the street on Trent Avenue, and there were these rows of little shops called labor sharks. Well, labor sharks hold jobs. You give a labor shark $4, and it entitled you to a job, say putting down a new mine shaft up in the Coeur d'Alene. Well, you'd boom up there to that job, burning up your road stake as you went. You get up there, work a month, get paid, and then fired. Why? Because the foreman on the job was splitting the labor fees with the shark in town. But crooked as hell, they called it perpetual motion, where you had one job, one worker going to the job, one worker on the job, one worker coming back to buy another damn job. Well, he said that the union, the Wobblies, IWW, they came into those towns all over the West, in Spokane, and to build union hiring halls to control the conditions of their labor. Well, the one in Missoula, Montana was burned down. The one in Spokane was torn down by the law. So the Wobblies went down on the street, and they put up soap boxes, and they get up on the soap box and start windmilling.
Hello, you're on the air.
This is Dan LaBox from Cincinnati, Ohio.
Hi, Dan. David Johnson here. Welcome to the show. We're really glad that you called in today.
I'm glad to be with you.
Hi, Dan. This is Jason. Thanks so much for calling in today and for joining us.
Happy to be here.
We want to talk about a few different things, especially in your background and some of the things you'd written during the course of the time that you're on. And I'll briefly reintroduce you to the listeners. Dan Labatz is a Latin American specialist who's also written books, many different books, but especially prominent ones that have been used quite frequently in the labor movement, such as Troublemaker's Handbook and Troublemaker's Handbook 2. And we'll start here with the interview. You ran as a socialist for a Senate seat in Ohio last fall.
I did.
And what motivated you to run, and what was the platform on which you ran?
Well, what motivated me to run was that I felt the country was in the deepest economic crisis of my lifetime, the deepest economic crisis since the Great Depression of the 1930s, that neither the Republicans nor the Democrats had any way out of the crisis that would be any good for the American people, and that the answers that were being provided by right-wing groups such as the Tea Party would be very damaging to working people and not resolve the problems at all, and also were increasing a kind of racist rhetoric in the country. And finally, because an interesting debate had developed around the question of whether or not President Obama was a socialist. And what is a socialist? And so for all those reasons, I thought it was important to run and to provide a vision of a different kind of society, one where working people would have power and we would attempt to take care of the needs of our society, beginning with those who are at the bottom of our society today, to take care of the needs of everyone, take care of, let's say, a working mother with a couple of kids, rather than to take care of a CEO. Right now, our objective in the country seems to make CEOs richer. So I decided to run and to run as a socialist, and the program and the platform I ran on was about the notion of having a democratic socialist society, one in which working people would control the most important industries in the nation, would control the wealth of the nation in such a way as to begin to reshape our priorities to take care of people. That is, that the big corporations have outlived their usefulness to humanity, whatever usefulness that was, and that those corporations should be socialized, that is, brought under the control of society as a whole. The way to get there, I think, and the way to get there, I argued, was through building working class power, that working people needed to have the power to make the changes necessary. And so that was the fundamental idea in very brief terms.
People can go to
danlabatz.com, and at that website they will find my platform, and find they can also go on YouTube and put in my name, Dan Labatz, that's L-A space capital B-O-T-Z, and they will find YouTube videos where I talk about some of these issues, and also on my danlabatz.com website there's a book I wrote for the campaign in which in a couple hundred pages I lay out what I think is happening in the nation.
How do you feel, especially looking back on it several months, that your campaign was received, and how would you reflect upon your experiences in which, among other things, I believe it was over 25,000 votes that you had pulled in, if that's correct?
That's correct. It's still less than 1%, you know, to be realistic and honest about it. It was a good showing, I thought, for a socialist candidate running with a vision of a revolutionary change in our society, a revolutionary transformation from corporate power to the power in the hands of working people. And so to get 25,000 votes, I thought was a success. I thought it was a wonderful experience from a personal point of view to travel around the state and both organize some meetings and attend public meetings, to have the socialist point of view in many different newspapers and on little TV interviews that in different areas they had, some really fun experiences. So all of that was good. One of the things I learned is that especially if you're a legitimate candidate, you can go out and talk to people about socialism. People will be interested to hear what you have to say, and I was treated respectfully and got a hearing in some pretty, you know, you go to public meetings in conservative areas, but people would say, well, what do you believe? And so I think that's important to know. We can go out and talk about socialism, and it's important to do so. At the same time, and sort of in full disclosure, it's very difficult to reach people in the labor union. The labor union officialdom does not want to have people who are not, does not want people who are not Democrats in there. They don't want Republicans or people to the right of the Republicans in general, with a few exceptions, and they certainly don't want anyone to the left of the Democratic Party coming in and having any access to speak in front of their members about what a just society is. So the role of the labor officials it was to make it impossible for me or other left candidates to speak in their meetings. And the other thing is, of course, the African American people in this country have faced a terrible experience for hundreds of years of racism and discrimination, oppression, exploitation, and now have a black president. And that was quite an amazing achievement in our country, to have a black man who could be elected president, even if many people who voted for him are disappointed and others of us recognize that he does not have any answers for this country, including for African American people. But so African American people in general certainly didn't want to hear criticism of the president, but one could talk about the issues and get a hearing. In other words, I often said sort of what I've just said now, that it was quite an achievement for our country to be able to elect a black man president. I think that represented a sea change in American racial attitudes. At the same time, I would say we have not had the change that many of you wanted. We do not see an end to wars. We do not see an improvement in the economy, and people are not getting jobs and so on. So I guess that's the strengths and weaknesses of the campaign as I saw it. Still, I think it was a terrific thing to do, and I think we need to have more socialist candidates running in many parts of the country to put that point of view out there. It's the one opportunity you have to go out and talk to thousands of people in an open way about the politics of socialism. That most days of the week, if I knock on somebody's door and say I'm here to talk about socialism, they throw me off the porch, you know. But when you come as a candidate in October or November, they stand there politely at the door and say, well, what do you have to say? Let me see your literature and so on. Hmm. So that's good.
Yes, Dan, I think that's really commendable that you ran, because, we know anyone that's been in the labor movement for a while has realized that the Democratic Party, is not representing working people. We can go back to we could go probably back farther than that. But I was going to say the case that always pops in my mind immediately is the Clinton administration's betrayal of working people with the passage of NAFTA, the China Preference Treaty, and other types of anti-worker actions and stuff. I think we need more a third-party working people running for office, both at the local level and as well as the national level. However, they think they can do it. I mean, as far as if it's a Socialist Party, Green Party, or whatever.
It's an interesting point, though.
Yes.
That right now, because of what's happened in Wisconsin, I think that's going to be more difficult. That is, in Wisconsin, the Democratic legislators appear to be the heroes. When the Republicans
yes.
went after their collective bargaining rights and are attacking the unions, it was the Democrats who fled the state, who held their ground, who refused to return to allow a vote. They became the fabulous or fantastic or something 14 in the minds of many.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and of course, they are different than the Republicans. So I think it requires a greater sophistication on our part to be able to talk about these differences. And one way to do it, of course, is to talk about how Cuomo in New York
yes.
or Brown in California are pressing austerity budgets just like the kinds of budgets that Republicans are pressing. But people say, but yes, they're not, however, trying to dismantle the labor union.
True.
So I think it makes our job harder.
Mm-hmm. On the other hand, yes, on the other hand, though, I mean, I noticed from this interviewing various people that have been up to Wisconsin and talking to people I know that have been there and seeing the media coverage myself is that, you know, of course, the Democratic Party and the union officialdom right away were talking about, you know, willing to agree to concessions, you know, but that wasn't the mood of the rank and file up there. I mean, it was like, you know, yes, the first order of line of defense should be to protect our collective bargaining rights, but no concessions. We've taken enough concessions. We didn't create the economic meltdown. Wall Street did, and lots of signs saying tax the rich. So it seems like the mood's out there amongst the rank and file. And
I think the mood is mixed, though.
Really? Okay.
I think that you have lots of people who are afraid what's going to happen
yes.
to my job. I mean, am I going to lose my job? Is my union going to be destroyed? Am I going to
mm-hmm,
lose?
Mm-hmm.
I think that there's a mix. I mean, I think that this is so often the case in American history. There's one group of people who are very angry and prepared to act.
Mm-hmm.
There's another group of people who are willing to go. You know, I was in Wisconsin since the big upheaval, just a week or so ago, for a labor notes troublemaker schools, they call them up there. And I went to the troublemaker school there, and I found that while some people were very committed to fighting, other people there talked about their fellow teachers or others who say, I just want this to be over. I want to get back to my life. I'm not ready to fight. So I think that we have to recognize that it's always our job to try to cohere that militant minority who can encourage others and get others to move forward with them and to build the force necessary to fight for change.
I think that's a good way to put it, especially because for so many in the labor movement and people who at times intermittently can be quite active, that the militancy and the fight is something so unusual in their lives, and people, especially in that segment, can often get quickly burnt out. They want a return to normal. They don't want the workplace relations or their public spaces invaded with strife to a good degree. And so that,
especially they're teaching little children. I'm a school
right.
teacher. I teach little children ages 6 to 14, and you feel an obligation to the students, to the parents. At the same time, you want to go out and you want to be part of the fight for what's right. And so I think the consciousness is mixed, and the ways to handle things require sophistication, and we have to figure out how to do that. I mean, I think those of us on this phone conversation agree, but the question is, how do we get the right approach to people?
Right. And speaking of Wisconsin, that similar occurrences legislatively have been going on in Ohio that I know you've been involved in mitigating against, that we have covered an awful lot about Wisconsin, and I know that nationally and regionally, Wisconsin's received a lot of attention, but in Ohio, you've had undergone similar anti-union fights that have in some ways extended beyond Wisconsin. One, because unlike in Wisconsin, some public sector workers, such as firefighters and police officers, have had their collective bargaining rights taken away. And two, because localities and schools are able to impose final contracts on them. And so in some ways, what's going on in Ohio has received less attention, but has been more extensively anti-union than what's going on in Wisconsin. So could you speak to that and what sort of efforts there have been, short-term and long-term, do you see resisting against this in Ohio?
Yeah, I think you laid out the basic points, which is all the unions are included and their ability to engage in collective bargaining on the whole range of issues is reduced, and arbitration is ended, so that therefore the employer's final offer is the final deal. And in addition to that, workers are required by law to make a greater contribution to health costs. So all of these things are worse. Of course, we should point out, I think, that this is, you know, there's also a tax on unions in Tennessee, where there have been mobilizations, in Idaho, and other states, and that this is going to be on the agenda. And, of course, this already happened in Indiana a few years ago. That is, Indiana already did what's going on in Wisconsin and Ohio, and they tried to move on the next step, which people should be looking out for, which is the next step is going to be to go after the rights of collective bargaining of people in the private sector by creating what are called right-to-work laws, which really mean an end to union shops or closed shops. And so this is really the opening round, or not the opening round, it's one step in a process of attacking labor union rights and workers' power and attempting to continue to reduce that. In Ohio, Ohio is not Wisconsin and is not Madison. I mean, I think it's worth pausing a moment to think about Madison, Wisconsin. And you have several things there that made Wisconsin different. You have a different kind of political culture in Wisconsin, which comes from several different things. For one, Wisconsin was the home of progressivism back in the 1910s. And there was this thing called the Wisconsin Idea, which was a kind of a vision of a more caring American capitalism, you might say. But it meant here you have the city, Madison, which is both the state capital, it has the big university just a couple blocks away, and you have, it's an industrial city as well. It's got, it's really where all these things come together. And Madison, Wisconsin was the La Follette, Fighting Bob La Follette, as he was called, who was a progressive of the 1920s, who came out of the 1910s and 20s, came out of that progressive movement and attempted to organize a progressive third party. You have many third party movements in Wisconsin. And, of course, Wisconsin was one of the biggest battlegrounds of the anti-war movement in the United States. And right. Many people who live in Wisconsin have in their memories and in their experience, in their personal experience, they're all people like me now who are older, but they're people who went through mass protests and strikes and demonstrations. Now, Columbus is a different place, and Ohio is a different place. We don't have those same political traditions. We don't have something like Progressive Dane, the Dane County political party. We don't have the same strong Green Party that exists in Wisconsin. There's not, Wisconsin had socialist mayors in some cities into the 60s. Mm-hmm. It had been a socialist stronghold. So all of those things affect the background political culture. And therefore, in Madison, you had a combination of union mobilization with a kind of popular upheaval against this stuff from both workers and students and people in the communities. Here in Ohio, we really have a very classic top-down kind of labor union mobilization. And the labor union leaders are joined at the hip to the Democratic Party. They are marching together with the goal of resisting Kasich and fighting against the attacks on the labor unions. But their goal is to take the raging river of protest that existed in Wisconsin and make sure that doesn't happen here and keep everything in the calm canals flowing along slowly, watering the Democratic Party precincts. And so So the goal is really here to keep everything, to turn out big demonstrations, all very orchestrated, all very controlled, and to have those demonstrations result in this area, not in a recalls, but in referenda. So in Wisconsin, they're going for the recall of the officials because they have the recall tradition from the progressive period. In Ohio, they're going for getting these things on the ballot so they can be defeated on the ballot as referenda. And if they do that, that also paralyzes the law for a period of time. But here in Ohio, there have to be hundreds of thousands of signatures collected. Now, I think all union people and all working people ought to be involved in collecting those signatures and attempting to give people the right to vote and defeating this legislation. But we have to do much more. We have to build a movement that really shows the economic as well as the political power of workers and that allows and it becomes much broader. I mean, even in Wisconsin, it was an interesting discussion when I was up there about what had been the role of the African-American population in Wisconsin. To what degree had they rallied to this? Of course, some African-Americans are public workers and through their unions became involved. But had people really tapped the anger among the African-American population, which may be less around union issues and more about budget issues and more about the cuts that will affect their communities? What about the Latino immigrant community? How can we reach the Latino population in general, but also particularly the Latino immigrant population? What do we do that really begins to create a mass movement here? I had, when my campaign ended, many of those who were involved in my campaign went into working on the Defend Ohio campaign. And we hoped, and we had some workers who were union activists and union officials and stewards and so on who were involved in this movement, but we found it virtually impossible to make any headway to have any real genuine democratic discussion or to have real coalitions through the labor union structures. And we found that our movement has been much more attractive to students, and now we find we're having springing up around the state Defend Ohio student organizations, which we had nothing to do with creating, but they like the name and they see what we're doing. So that's good. But we don't really, I think we have to find a way to say we need more of a fight here in Ohio. And this came up in Wisconsin, that is, where things are going to remain in political channels. The teachers went on strike up there 2 days in Wisconsin, and then the Wisconsin Education Association went on strike for 4 days, I believe. So you had a couple days of what could be called a sick-in that was really kind of a wildcat strike, and then you had an official strike. That was really a beginning of showing the potential power of workers, and we haven't seen that carried forward. I think that's the question. We could really use the power of workers economically, and we haven't figured out how to do that.
Dan, it sounds like more and more people really need to have a copy of your book, A Troublemaker's Handbook, in their hands, because I just want to mention I used to be a carpenter in the Carpenters Union, and your book and TDU was a big influence on us. Of course, it seems like we keep coming back to the same problem where the union officialdom, with their revolving door with the Democratic Party, and as you mentioned so accurately, joined at the hip, if you will. The only way this is going to change is if rank and file people can get control of their locals and ultimately their internationals. So I just had to throw that in as a comment. I've been looking over your book here. It's been quite a few years since I read it, but just going through it, it's like everything you need in here to really do what needs to be done.
Thank you very much for saying that. I actually went to a founding meeting of a Carpenters for a Democratic Union. I don't know if that group...
out in Boston?
Survived. This was a national meeting. I think it was held in Boston.
Yes, I was there.
It was, mm-hmm. Oh, you were?
Yes.
And then of course, I wanted to say that the Troublemaker's Handbook, if people go to labornotes.org, all one word, labornotes.org, they can buy Troublemaker's Handbook number 2, which Jane Slaughter edited, which I wrote a good part of. I was the writer of the first Troublemaker's Handbook, but was involved in both of them. And you're right, it's a real manual that allows, it's based on telling stories. I was asked to write a kind of a manual, and I thought, well, people really learn best by stories, and it's most convincing if working people tell their own story of how they did something. So we tried to collect a lot of the best stories of workers who were successful in fighting against the employers, fighting against union officials who weren't doing their job, tackling the questions of racism and sexism on the job, dealing with issues of gay and lesbian liberation, tackling political questions. So we really tried to make it a handbook for every aspect of a union member's work. I think one of the issues is that it's really a handbook for union members. And, of course, today only 10% of workers are in unions. And we really need to work on reaching out to the other 90%. But many of the things in that book are useful to non-unionized workers, particularly the first part of the book about some of the fundamentals of organizing. But I think thank you for mentioning it. Labornotes.org. People can buy a copy.
I think that we've all been familiar with, we know many others who are very familiar with this book. I've not gotten the second one, but I have the first and I'm pretty familiar with it. What I'm taken by so much, and I've read bits of the second online, but especially in reading your foreword to the first, you say in many ways it's not a history book and not intended to be, and yet in so many ways it really is. In reading this, in the things you're talking about, especially in the first one about labor management programs, quality of work life, rank and file resistance in workplace actions, when you talk about Jerry Tucker so much, and in the second one too, where you're talking about different kinds of tactics and different kinds of problems, in many ways these are how-to manuals, and at the same time, especially with the evolution of the problems that workers are facing between when you wrote the first and when you wrote the second, in many ways your handbooks are how-tos as well as history books for working people.
Yeah, I suppose that's true.
I wanted to talk at least briefly in the last few minutes what we had about, we talk so much about solutions or fishing for solutions. And I don't know to what degree this is feasible here, but there was certainly in Wisconsin an awful lot of talk about a general strike. And I think in any sort of mass action, but that especially here has legal ramifications and it's problematic to some degree to even do. But in the second Troublemakers Handbook, there were days of actions that were, as you put it, in effect, general strikes from 1995 to 1998 in Ontario that were rolling job actions in which various groups of workers, especially in the public sector, were heavily involved in shutting down cities and industries across Ontario with some success, especially motivating people politically against this conservative government. To what degree do you think that this is feasible here? And what sort of obstacles would it face here in the U.S. and on at least a smaller scale? What would it take for something like that to occur?
Well, I thought it was interesting at the going up to Wisconsin and being involved in that troublemaker school to hear the discussion. And there was no clear agreement. And they did, this was a group of very militant and radical labor activists, I would say, who were there. And there was no clear agreement that it would have been possible to carry out a general strike there. Though I think it may well have been for a few moments, for a few days, really, in that process. But it would have taken a group of workers who were very clearly committed and had a very clear vision of what they were doing. I mean, one of the things that comes up, is that workers say, "What about my house? What about my car? I'm going to lose my job. I could be fired." That is, this. When you talk about a general strike, these are very often strikes which may not. They may violate the law. They certainly will violate collective bargaining agreements. Most American collective bargaining agreements have no strike clauses mm-hmm. in them. And so it takes a tremendous degree of commitment and clarity to be able to achieve that, as well as the, right now people feel a lot of anger and a lot of resentment at government officials, as if for people who are cutting their wages, taking away their union rights, forcing them to pay more for health care, stealing their pensions. Mistreating them on the job, just the general mistreatment that allows to go on people's jobs every day. And people are angry about that. But anger is not the sufficient sufficient basis for a strike. There has to be the organization. So I think the key, could it happen in the United States? Certainly it could happen. Could it happen right now in the United States? I think there are a few places with that level of organization and political clarity and so on. In a place like Wisconsin, where they just now overthrew that judge's election, right? It seems to me that they're getting quite an education there, and more people are, come to have a political clarity about what's really happening to them here and what's involved. Now, will there be another chance in Wisconsin? I don't know. I think it takes organization. It takes political clarity about what you're doing. It also takes a question of the opportunity of the moment. In Wisconsin, there sort of was a week there that was the time, or a few days that was the time. And if you don't act, then the moment passes, as in so many things in life, you have to seize the time. So Could it happen? Well, yes, it's happened in, you know, it's happened recently in Canada in those Ontario days of action. It happens in Europe and Latin America every day. Workers here are fundamentally no different. They're capable of both reaching